The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The province now referred to as British Columbia in that part of northern Avyayala that we call Canada has officially decriminalized the simple possession of very small amounts of some drugs. Limited decrim is just one small part of what's going on in the land to the north. We talk about that and more on today's show with our guest Eris Nix from the Drug User Liberation Front. But first, the state of Oregon passed Measure 110, the Drug Addiction Treatment and Recovery Act, in the 2020 general election by an overwhelming margin. M110 combined decriminalization of simple possession of some drugs with increased funding for vital services around the state. Measure 110's passage was a direct and unmistakable repudiation of business as usual when it comes to policies affecting people who use drugs. Unfortunately, the agencies and others who prefer business as usual are working to stymie progress. We reported recently on a harm reduction legislative package in Oregon. Today, we're going to look at a bill that goes in the wrong direction. Oregon House Bill 2089 would yank millions of dollars in Measure 110 funding away from agencies doing good work around the state and redirect that money back down the rat hole of cities, counties, and state police. The Oregon Legislature's House Committee on Revenue held a hearing on HB 2089 on February 2nd. We're going to hear from a few of the witnesses. First, here's Ron Williams, who's a member of the Measure 110 Oversight and Accountability Council.
For the record, my name is Ron Williams. I reside in Portland, Oregon, House District 45. I'm a member of the Measure 110 Oversight and Accountability Council, which is responsible for providing grants and funding to establish behavioral health resource networks in every county and provide access to care grants. The behavioral health resource networks and access to care grantees provide the critical services made available by Measure 110 funding. I am here as a member of the council, but I'm not speaking on behalf of the council. I'm speaking as a person in long-term recovery, which means I've been alcohol and drug free for going on 23 years. And I know firsthand the benefits of peer support, detox, and accessible housing for people seeking to improve the quality of their lives through addiction recovery services. I'm here today in opposition to House Bill 2089. This bill would be devastating to Measure 110 funded addiction recovery services across the state at a time when access to addiction recovery services should be prioritized and expanded. Initially, when the council put out the RFGA for proposals, request for grant applications for proposals, there were almost $400 million in requests from providers to provide services. The council only had $265 million to work with. So the request for proposals, there was a huge amount of providers who were seeking to provide services, and there just wasn't enough funding to meet the need. And we know the need is great, and you'll hear repeatedly today that Oregon ranks worst in the nation in terms of access to care. Ballot Measure 110 was passed in response to the overdose and addiction crisis. Measure 110 funding has established networks of providers in every county working together to ensure folks who want and need peer support, housing along a continuum, including emergency, transitional, supportive, recovery, permanent, and family housing, low barrier treatment like detox, sobering, and residential inpatient for folks who are uninsured or categorically ineligible for Medicaid, harm reduction, supported employment. Now folks can receive those services, expanded set of services. According to OHA's own data collection and reporting, and as you may have seen in their press release yesterday, more than 60,000 people have received Measure 110 services across the state in the first year of implementation. Many of these providers are small organizations receiving state funding for the first time. Many of these organizations provide peer support, housing, harm reduction, and other service to culturally specific populations. House Bill 2089 would take away an estimated $30 to $40 million away from Measure 110 funding. which would drastically and negatively impact delivery of addiction recovery services and cause programs to shut down just as they are beginning to show meaningful results.
Thank you for your comments. Do you have just one final sentence?
At a time when deadly drugs are prevalent and overdoses are skyrocketing, this is not the time to cut addiction recovery services. I'm imploring you to preserve funding for these critical services. Lives will be saved. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony.
I'm Andy Coe. I'm Executive Director of Partnership for Safety and Justice. And Chair Nathanson knows about us, but I'm going to tell you a little bit about us. We are an organization that advocates for public safety and criminal justice reform that advances equity, accountability, and healing. And so that's our perspective in approaching this work. And I'm going to keep it very short because as I was listening to the other testimony, it occurred to me in a way that it hadn't before how complex this is. And I had to look up Gordian knot, and that was the first thing that came to my mind. We at Partnership for Safety and Justice, as one of our objectives, we support local innovation in criminal justice reform with the idea that local communities can keep people in their communities healthy, safe, not causing problems, ideally, in out-of-state prisons and out of jails, which are extremely expensive and don't usually make better citizens. And one of the things, again, that occurs to us constantly is that local government needs resources to be able to do this. We are opposing 2089 because with the Measure 110 funds, we're not starting with a program, a system that's at surplus. We're talking with something about something that's still in a deficit situation. And because of that, if we were to do what I think is being proposed, and there has been some estimates that $40 million would be taken out of the system, and a long list of counties would lose about 50% of their funding, that would impact rural communities, that would impact people on living on the edge in a way that I think is not intended by the legislation that this committee is reviewing and considering right now.
Thank you.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Tabitha Jensen. I use she, her, and they, them pronouns, and I'm the deputy director at New Avenues for Youth. We are grateful and humbled by the funding that we received through Measure 110 to expand services to the youth we serve in Multnomah and Clackamas counties, ages 9 to 24. These are early interventions in a lot of cases. We provide trusting relationships to support harm reduction practices, walking alongside youth for peer services, and then providing linkage to our burn partners for treatment. We oppose House Bill 2089, and one of the things I think is so important in solidarity to point out as a dominant culture organization, we're doing great work with our expansion, but this mechanism created low barrier funding that channeled dollars directly to the communities that were most impacted by the war on drugs. It should not go without recognition. We've heard concerns raised by legal cannabis operations today. Those we know are predominantly owned and operated by white folks. And this would be a perpetuation of further harm to communities of color who have family members and community members of ours that are currently in prison for the same types of activities. And so I think that's something we really need to hold in addition to thinking of all the communities impacted and funded partners.
You just heard Tabitha Jensen, Deputy Director of New Avenues for Youth. She was preceded by Andy Coe, Executive Director of the Partnership for Safety and Justice. And the first speaker was Ron Williams, who's a member of the Measure 110 Oversight and Accountability Council. They're testifying in the Oregon Legislature's House Committee on Revenue against House Bill 2089. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. That part of Northern Abya-Yala, which is now referred to as British Columbia, has decriminalized simple possession of some drugs. Decriminalization does not mean legalization. There is no regulated sale allowed. Ultimately, it only means that the penalties have been lowered for people over the age of 18 to possess very small amounts of some drugs. There's great symbolic value for drug policy reformers, but what does it really mean for people in BC and the rest of Canada? On Zoom with me now is Aris Nix with the Drug User Liberation Front in Vancouver, British Columbia. Aris, how are you today?
I'm okay. It's Friday. Friday feels good.
Yes, it does. There's so much I want to ask you about. But first, let me run through some numbers to provide some context for listeners outside Canada. BC's decrim law, went into effect on Tuesday, January 31st. Also on January 31st, the BC Coroner's Office announced that 2,272 people in the province had died in 2022 from an unregulated drug supply and drug overdose. I wanted to have numbers to compare, but we don't have an estimate yet for the U.S. for 2022, but we do have the totals for 2021. According to the CDC, in the U.S. in 2021, 106,699 drug overdose deaths occurred. That results in an age-adjusted rate of 32.4 per 100,000 standard population in the U.S. According to the BC government, in 2021, the province saw 2,306 deaths from an unregulated illegal drug supply and overdose for a death rate per 100,000 population of 44.2. Now, there are some specifics about the law that we're going to get into. I know there are some problems with it, this new law. I think, well, it's a three-year pilot program, actually. But before we get to all those, do you think this is going to have any positive impacts?
No. No, it don't. I mean, I just think you have to think about things in terms of why they're happening, right? I know, and I don't want to close my window here because I live in the downtown east side and people are breaking glass outside of it, but I don't want to throw drug users who have worked on this under the bus, you know? I think it's not really worth it. And I do think in a lot of ways, decriminalization was a very important thing to people. And it would have, you know, 10 years ago been a lot different. But given the circumstance we're finding ourselves in now, it's creating, you know, the illusion that something is being done to stem the death from the toxic drug supply when absolutely nothing is happening in that regard. By which I mean, you can possess drugs, sure. And these are charges that weren't being enforced, at least in the downtown east side in Vancouver. You know, I don't know about the rest of British Columbia, but no one is getting charged with simple possession. It's possession with intent, trafficking, whatever, blah, blah, blah. You have a scale, you're breaching the terms of your probation, whatever you might be doing. That's what the actual charges are. So this, you know, people getting busted with or possession, I'm not sure it's actually happening. But even if there was like a positive impact from that, there's no positive impact on the drug supply itself. And if the drug supply is toxic and volatile, legally being allowed to access it without having the other piece, which is obviously a regulated drug supply, doesn't mean we're going to see this stem, how many deaths are occurring. And there's a very convoluted argument that, oh, well, if we decriminalize drugs, it'll destigmatize drug users, blah, 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 and they'll be safer and they'll use drugs more safely. But I just don't. I'm like, you have to regulate this very volatile drug supply. And in some places, for example, in Prince George in British Columbia, I just realized this, their death rate is 1 in 1,000. 1 in 1,000 Prince George residents every year die of an overdose. Well, that is crazy. Like, you know, when you phrase it like that, if you whatever, I'm like, that's really abysmal. And even I, like yesterday morning, I got some email and it was like, can you please help us find clean drugs for our son? Like someone had sent me an email that said, you know, in many ways kind of disturbed me, I suppose. Because I don't think it should come to that, right? And I can't imagine what kind of parent would be in a position they're emailing me on some kind of Hail Mary thing to help them find clean drugs so their child doesn't die. That must be, you know, quite an abysmal situation. Sorry, that was a very roundabout way of answering that. But no, I do not think decriminalization is going to make a difference here.
Oh, no, I appreciate the thoughts. And wow. Yeah, because 44.2 per 100,000, that was, you know, that's for the entire province. That's not just for the cities. I mean, that's a big, you got it. Yeah, there's a lot of people and they're not all crammed into one city. We don't,
U.S. listeners, we think of Canada as being just one sort of place, a lot of empty space in a couple of cities, and that's the end of it. But you actually have a lot of people living in rural areas. And the rural areas are one of the things I wanted to talk to you about when it gets to the, but okay, I know we've gone over a little bit of this before, but I think that some things are worth repeating. You know, people can use a reminder. So about the program, for instance, it's a 3-year pilot program. This isn't actually a new law that's been put into effect. It's an exemption from Health Canada and it's to last 3 years. There's a limit, for possession. It's 2.5 grams of some substances, which include, according to the fact sheet, opioids, cocaine, methamphetamine, and MDMA. I mean, that's a combined total of just 2.5 grams. That seems kind of low. Is that, I mean, for the benefit of listeners who may not know, well, may not know much about metric weight generally, let alone the in the context of controlled substances. Am I right in saying that 2.5 grams is not all that bloody much?
I mean, it depends on who you are very, very heavily. And I think some of the upper estimates people are giving, you know, I need to be able to hold 14 grams a day for personal use. I think things start becoming a little extreme. The problem, I think, is the cumulative, right? It's not 2.5 grams of each substance. It's you can have 2.5 grams of heroin or down, crystal meth, cocaine, or MDMA for some reason, despite the fact that there's no fentanyl toxicity. You can have 2.5 grams of those drugs cumulatively and not be breaking the law. But I'm like, when you think about it, if you had some of each drug, you can only have 0.5 gram of each drug. And that certainly is not enough for the average user. And then even if you're partying, you know, most people are going to do more than 0.5 gram of a drug in a day. So I have questions, but to go back to it, I'm like, nobody's getting jacked up for possession of that little amount of drugs. Anyway, I'm like, to me, this all just seems like a bit of a smoke and mirror show to draw attention away from the fact that people are not, you know, getting the help they need and getting access to a clean and safe drug supply at the end of the day.
Indeed. It's, as you were saying, they want to be seen to be doing something, whether it's something that'll work or something that, or whether it's the right thing, that's another question. But be seen to be doing something seems to be what's important.
Yes, I think, you know, and there was a lot of push for this for the last 20 years in Vancouver. And I don't deny that it was appropriate then, but I'm like, the playing field is very different now.
Well, you know, exactly. 20 years ago, some of these moves that we're finally making now down here in the U.S. and there in Canada, 20 years ago would have been probably game-changing. As it is now, too late. Hopefully, God knows if it's going to be too little. Anyway, the thing you mentioned, though, when you said down as opposed to heroin, I've been looking through some of the drug checking service reports from up there, and I've noticed that, and I thought that was interesting that you had the drug category is referred to as down, not as opioids or the rest, but as down. What's the reason for that?
I'm actually not sure about that. And decriminalization. I got to look this up before I start telling you a bunch of false information.
Well, the question I have about down is just because I noticed that some of these, for instance, there's benzos. Do you got?
Well, this is the thing. This is where I'm like, I don't actually know how it says it in the exemption. I'm trying to find the exact wording.
Oh, I've got the wording right here.
From my understanding, it's just heroin.
Yes.
And fentanyl, not benzos.
I've got it right in front of me. I'll read it to you. Adults 18 plus in BC can possess or hold a total amount equal to or less than 2.5 grams of these illegal drugs for personal use. Opioids, including heroin, morphine, and fentanyl. Cocaine, including crack and powder cocaine. Methamphetamine, or meth. MDMA, or ecstasy. Adults in possession of up to 2.5 grams of these drugs for personal use will not be arrested, charged, fines, or have their drugs seized. Instead, information about voluntary health and social supports will be offered. Municipal bylaws on public use may apply. That is a quote from the BC government's decriminalization fact sheet. Decriminalization of people who use drugs in BC. which was the version dated October 6th of 2022. I'll be as complete as possible.
So I think to go back to your earlier question, and this is, pardon me for misspeaking earlier, but this is going to be a huge problem. In Vancouver, not that I think any of this is getting enforced, though. That's the thing. I'm like, this isn't going to make a difference. Like, I'm picking apart an exemption that, you know, has no bearing on the actual community here. But in theory, this would be a huge problem because the majority of our opioid supply is contaminated with benzodiazepine, right? And that drug is not in this exemption list. So the question starts to become, like, if they jacked you up and you had 2.5 grams of down, but the down had benzos in it, how's the cop going to know that? It's not like they're walking around with testing infrastructure or test strips or, like, you know what I mean? I'm like, they're adding layer upon layer of problematic and confusing legislation that's not going to address a problem that's much...
We see, and that actually is my next question. This fact sheet again says that people won't have their drugs seized if they're within the limits. But are people? I mean, would police actually be carrying scales and testing equipment? I mean, how are they supposed to know if it's 2.5 grams or if it's actually 3.5 grams? Again, for folks not familiar with metrics, a gram is a very small amount. Are they going to be able to eyeball necessarily the difference between 2.5 grams that's decriminalized and 3 grams, which would be illegal? Are they going to be testing? Are they carrying testing equipment so they can tell whether that powder that's been sold as a down contains benzos or is it fentanyl with heroin or is it just baking soda? I mean.
Yeah, and I think there's even further problems. The VPD released an infographic, and at the bottom of that, it said, like, do not get confused because of packaging material, blah, blah, blah. Like, 2.5 grams in the package is 4.8 grams. And it's not very clear what they mean in terms of enforcement, like, in the sense that are they weighing packaging material? Are they not weighing packaging material? And on virtue of the fact that something's flapped up, I thought you'd be instantly guilty of possession with intent to traffic. I don't know. To go back to the actual application point, I'm like, it's not gonna, the exemption, this entire thing will make no difference, you know. And I would like to see examples. I would have loved to see the people that were getting arrested for possession, you know, talk to those people, just sheer possession.
As you're saying,
it used to happen to me a lot as a kid, you know, but not as an adult.
Well, and people under the age of 18 will still face the same criminal charges as before.
Yeah, and that's preposterous. Imagine being under 18 and selling heroin and then going to jail for the rest of your life. I'm like, that's pretty dark, man.
And of course, this decrim program also allows municipalities to impose their own criminal penalties. Campbell River, I was just reading a news story, the city of Campbell River passed a bylaw banning the use of drugs on public property. Approved the bylaw just before anyone consuming controlled substances in public places like parks or city property could face a $200 fine. Would public property include places like, a public library bathroom?
I mean, I don't know.
I
think it's like again, the context in Vancouver is so different. So I'm like, we have people shooting up all over the street. So these kind of questions, once you start, you know, hitting the brass tacks of application of this in a different community, things really start changing.
And even in the context of Vancouver and the downtown east side, I suppose it would make some people feel good knowing that the law still prohibits public use. Okay, so do you really think the police are going to do a sweep of downtown east side and pick up people who are using in public?
I think it's discretionary, right? It says this somewhere in the law. I'm sorry, I haven't refreshed myself on how this works before hopping on this call, but it's up to a municipality where and when they enforce. And so I don't think in Vancouver, I can't see what I've seen in Vancouver is the cops sweeping the streets and talking to dealers and being like, hey, what you're doing is still illegal. But they haven't even been picking up the dealers. I'm like, it's such a widespread problem. There are so many people using drugs in Vancouver, let alone so many injection drug users, whatever. They can't just go, if they if they tried to start arresting people, they'd probably arrest half the city, you know? Like, that's a reality of the fact.
Well, so. It goes back to the, you know, seen to be doing something. So they're seen, they passed a law, there we go, and we're not...
Yeah, and then you go to my kind of position where I'm watching everyone die, and it's a real catastrophe, let's put it that way.
Yeah. I suppose the thing about public use speaks to the need for more for safe consumption sites. Well, it speaks to the need for housing. I mean, housing in a sense is a safe consumption space as long as people are allowed to smoke or drink or whatever in those private spaces. I mean, if you don't have a private space, then the then an actual safe consumption site. And I mention that a lot on this show, in which, you know, we've talked about that before. As you know, down here in the U.S., there are currently two legally authorized safe consumption spaces in the entire United States. Both of them are located in New York City, a couple of the different boroughs. But that's it. That's it. The city of San Francisco is still discussing the question. The city of Seattle was discussing it a few years ago, and I think that's kind of fallen by the wayside to wait until somebody else does something. The city of Philadelphia tried, but the federal government stepped in and stopped them, and now they're trying to negotiate with the feds to get it to happen again. Now, BC's program is very specific about only possession being decriminalized. Production and sale are still banned. And of course, there are these medicalized safer supply programs in existence up there in Canada, which Dulf's safe supply program is very different from the medicalized safer supply programs that are in existence. And you just had another drug distribution event a couple of days ago. Yeah. How did it go?
I mean, we do it every time the coroner releases numbers, right? And that's probably about once a month. And now we're on the 13th distribution. Like, this has been going on for so long, even just that element of the crisis, us giving away free drugs when they announce these numbers. So it's become very mundane. And the press in Canada has ceased to care. In fact, the international press also, by extension, I suppose, no one gives a what we're doing. I think more importantly is the fact that we're running a brick and mortar store and we're on month six of doing that. And we haven't caused a single... have not caused a single overdose, and we haven't caused, you know, harm as far as we're concerned from the evidence we're gathering.
You've opened up a brick and mortar shop.
Yes, but it's only for specific folks.
Well,
like you have to be granted access. Not anyone can just walk off the street, if you follow what I mean.
That was part one of my conversation with Aris Nix from the Drug User Liberation Front in Vancouver, BC. We'll hear the rest of that conversation on next week's show. You can learn more about Dulf at their website, dulf.ca. That's dulf.ca. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy. We'll